Welcome to the Corporate Social Responsibility Podcast. I'm your host, David Yosefan, Associate Professor of Law at Santa Clara University School of Law here in sunny Santa Clara, California. We had a very special guest on our campus here this week at Santa Clara University, His Holiness the Dalai Lama. The visit was anticipated around here for about 2 weeks. Started getting the emails. For 2 weeks running, the special bunting came out. It's usually reserved for graduation or alumni, but it was hung about, and our always sparkling, beautiful campus was put even into a greater shine. And you could hear buzz in the hallways, people talking about the Dalai Lama coming, people asking if you had gotten tickets. There was a great excitement, a great enthusiasm, a great expectation. I was really touched by that, and I was curious about it. What was it about this man that created such universal appeal, or such happiness, such excitement, such certainty that what he was bringing to our campus was going to be an unmitigated good, that he was most surely going to bring some wisdom to us, was going to have a positive impact on our community. I was particularly curious about his visit because the theme or the title of his visit was Business, Ethics, and Compassion, a public dialogue. So the Dalai Lama was coming here to Silicon Valley to talk about the relationship between his life's work or his vision of compassion and business. This is, of course, highly relevant to our pursuit of corporate social responsibility in this podcast, our consideration of the proper role of corporations in our society. In the weeks before this visit, I have myself been grappling with a concept or an idea that I'm calling the myth of long-term value in corporate operations. The myth of long-term value is my way of responding to proponents of existing corporate law or proponents of the shareholder primacy norm in corporate operations who claim that the shareholder primacy norm will benefit all corporate stakeholders in the long term, that it is all right for us to have a corporate law that instructs directors to be focused on pursuing corporate profits, pursuing profits for shareholders, because enlightened directors will recognize that in the long run, it's going to be most profitable for corporations to treat its consumers well, that will attract consumer dollars, treat its workers well, that will attract the best workers and help retain them, treat communities well, that will help create a welcoming regulatory atmosphere for the corporation. And so this view of the long-term value tells us, insists that there's no problem with shareholder primacy, there's no problem with there's no conflict between corporate social responsibility and shareholder primacy, because over the long term, corporations will recognize that serving all of their stakeholders well is what is in the best interests of the shareholders. And so there's a consonance over the long term, we're told, between shareholder interests and other stakeholder interests, the interests of other constituencies. I think that this vision is just flat out wrong or confused in a number of respects. As I've tried to make the case on this podcast in previous episodes, I think that this vision is unresponsive to the insight or the possibility, the prediction, that once we charge directors with maximizing profits for shareholders, they're going to look for profits wherever they can be found, and one of the places they might be found is by exploiting or overreaching or misleading non-shareholding stakeholders like consumers with respect to, for example, the adverse health consequences that might result from consuming a corporation's product, be it a cigarette or a Big Mac. or a cell phone. Corporations might seek profits by undermining worker safety or skimping on worker safety in ways that it is difficult for workers to observe themselves. For example, I've used the example of putting asbestos, using asbestos as insulation in the workplace, which it might be harmful to worker health, but profitable for shareholders. We're told by defenders of the shareholder primacy norm to nevertheless have faith that in the long term, those kinds of adverse practices will wash out. That ultimately, those are short-term gains, and the greater profits are ultimately going to be realized by being responsible. To me, this is really a kind of faith-based corporate theory. I really see no evidence for it or no reason to believe that that's true. I think that long-term story seems appealing to us in part because it strikes us as morally appropriate to be taking a long-term view on things rather than a short-term view. Short-term view strikes us as hedonistic, or a short-term view strikes us as evidencing a failure to delay gratification. There's a virtue in delaying gratification. There's a virtue in resisting the short-term perspective. And so when we're told that over the long term, shareholder primacy is going to be beneficial to all, the very phrase, the long term, the very appeal to the long term, carries with it a moral inflection that I think blinds us or misleads us into thinking that it's coherent or desirable. But I think it's neither coherent nor desirable. Even from the perspective of shareholders alone, let me pursue this idea for a moment with respect to shareholders alone. We're often told that the problem with corporate governance, or one of the problems with corporate governance in the subprime mortgage fiasco, is that directors were too focused on short-term profits, and that what we want from our corporate directors is to focus on long-term value. And here again, I think that the appeal to long-term value is rhetorically persuasive. It sounds right, but it masks, I think it covers up a deeper problem, the deeper problem in our corporate governance law. And that is our corporate governance law's failure to confront the reality, the irreducible reality, the inescapable reality that corporate stakeholders, different corporate stakeholders, are sometimes going to have interests that are in competition with each other, that are in tension with each other. If we take this merely from the shareholder perspective, it can be easily seen. Some shareholders in a corporation need short-term profits, and it's not theoretically morally bankrupt for them to be desiring short-term profits. Perhaps our short-term shareholder is very elderly. Perhaps they need short-term profits in order to be able to pay for managed care, to be able to pay for assisted living. Maybe our shareholder who's seeking short-term profits is in dire need of is a young person in dire need of a medical procedure that they can't otherwise pay for unless they get short-term profits. Perhaps our shareholder is an institutional investor that is trying to generate profits in order to feed people, in order to fund a nonprofit operation, to fund a philanthropic operation that is trying to feed people in all around the world who are starving right now. Okay, people are starving on the planet today. They have a short-term perspective, and that short-term perspective is legitimate. The long-term perspective is not only irrelevant to those who are starving now, it's positively adverse to their interests. And of course, the long-term interest is also perfectly legitimate. If I'm investing on behalf of my very young children and I'm not counting on returns, I'm not looking for returns from that investment for 30 years, 20 years to pay for their education, then I'm not interested in a high stakes, high risk, short-term investment. I'm legitimately interested in a long-term investment. The short-term investment is positively adverse to that long-term perspective. Both the short-term and the long-term are legitimate. And there are inescapable tensions between the legitimate desires and values of each of those positionalities. And saying that we should have that our corporate governance should be focused on long-term value evades that problem, masks that problem in a misty rhetoric rather than confronting it. And even still, if we return now, move away from the focus on shareholders alone and we consider multi-stakeholder interests, maybe it's, even if it were true, and I see no reason to believe it is, but even if it were true that in the very long term, firms operating under the shareholder primacy norm will ultimately come to understand that serving their stakeholders well with dignity is the best way to maximize profits. Maybe even if it were true that in the long durée, as the French say, that over the long duration, firms that serve their constituencies well will be profitable and will ultimately put the exploitative firms out of business. Even if that were true, how long are we talking about? How long is the long term? Is it even in this generation? Is it 100 years? Is it 1,000 years? Can we, in our corporate theory, ask the present generation to suffer the indignities that shareholder primacy visits upon them in return for the promise that many generations hence or sometime in the unspecified future, it's going to work itself out? If we're talking about hundreds of years or decades, tens of years, can the earth, can the environment even last that long under the exploits of shareholder primacy? The concerns of the present generation are in tension with the concerns of the future generation. And we may think with a particular ethical outlook that we have a moral responsibility to the future. But where should we direct that moral responsibility? Should we design our institutional arrangements in such a way that we think is going to produce the most efficient, effective form of economic arrangements 100 years from now? Or should we say that we need to press for economic arrangements that are going to be more desirable 50 years from now or 40 years from now? How do we balance the interests of children who are born into the working class today versus children who are born into a working class 100 years from now? I'm not proposing that I have any solution to these moral problems, these organizational problems, these problems of theory and design. My point is that these problems don't go away when we talk about the myth of the long term, the myth of long-term value. But the beauty of that myth, the elegance of that myth, I think keeps us from confronting the problem. Now, this was in my mind, and I've been working on this idea in anticipation of the Dalai Lama's visit. Anticipating his visit, I sort of had been wondering, what will he have to say? What will the Dalai Lama have to say about business ethics and compassion? Confess to not really knowing that very much about the Dalai Lama. I think that I know about as much liberal American growing up in the late 20th and now living in the early 21st centuries. Is that right? I think it is. And maybe even a little bit more than the average person, because I have a particular interest in religion myself. I practice meditation, have from time to time been exposed to the Dalai Lama's thinking, I suppose, on numerous matters. I remember after, I think it was between somewhere between graduate school and law school, I picked up a book of his called, the title of the book was A Policy of Kindness. And I don't even think I ever read that book, but I carried it around with me for years in my collection of books. And I just read that title again and again and saw his smiling visage on that title, A Policy of Kindness. And I think that affected me over the years, just having it on my bookshelf. So anyway, the night before the Dalai Lama was coming, I thought, well, I should at least get on the Wikipedia page and do a quick Wikipedia read about the Dalai Lama so I have some context in which to understand, to listen to what he's saying. But it was the end of a long day. Been up, you know, since 5 a.m. with the two little ones, blessings that they are. By the time all the chores are completed and the work of the day is completed, I start to glaze over looking at a long Wikipedia entry on the Dalai Lama. But I did scan it. And the thing that jumped out at me in reading that, in scanning through it, was the issue of the next Dalai Lama. So the Dalai Lama purports to be the reincarnation of the Dalai Lama, the 14th reincarnation of the Dalai Lama, who is and has been for hundreds of years the religious and political leader of the Tibetan people. I actually want to drop a footnote here to remark that midway through the day in the Dalai Lama's visit, in reading some of the material that was made available in connection with his visit, I learned something which I had not known before, but which really excited me, which was that in 2011, I'm just going to read it here. One of his greatest reforms, that is the Dalai Lama's reforms, came in 2011 when the transition to democracy was completed for the Central Tibetan Administration. The formal transfer of power to a democratically elected leader brought to an end the 368-year tradition of the Dalai Lama being both spiritual and political head of Tibet. So you may know that Tibet is geographically located in central China. And I'm not going to get into the political controversies about Tibet's struggle for political autonomy. Obviously, the Dalai Lama has been a great leader in the Tibetan people's political struggle for autonomy within the Chinese authority, and he received the Nobel Peace Prize in connection with that work and his promotion of a peaceful, non-violent resistance to the authoritarian regime in which the Tibetan people struggle and continue to struggle. But I was quite excited to read and to learn that the Dalai Lama has inherited political position and turned it over to a democratic process. I think that speaks volumes about the man's integrity, about his vision, and the continuing vitality of the Dalai Lama as an institution. And as a small R Republican, as an American committed to the values of democracy, I became I was put much more at ease in the whole course of the day, after realizing that this person no longer purported to hold an inherited political office. And not only that, but that he had himself been a leader in transforming that inherited political system into a democratic system. But there still remains the question of the Dalai Lama's reincarnation. I read on that Wikipedia page what I had heard before, read, I guess, previously in newspaper accounts or something, that the Dalai Lama has said that he is not entirely certain about whether he is going to reincarnate again as the Dalai Lama. He said he's 87 now, and he said that as he begins to approach death in this life, he's going to consult with the spiritual leaders of Tibetan Buddhism and reflect himself with among the Tibetan people to determine whether or not the Dalai Lama should be reincarnated again, or and whether the institution of the Dalai Lama as a spiritual leader should continue. But he made very clear in his discussion that it's up to him, that it's up to his person. I'm not going to get deeply into the metaphysics of reincarnation. It's certainly far beyond the business judgment rule, far beyond my expertise. But what became very clear to me is that he absolutely, with conviction, believes that he is reincarnated, that he lived previously as the previous Dalai Lama and the Dalai Lama's previous to that, he is a continuing person through these reincarnations. And he says, on this Wikipedia page, that it's up to him whether he's going to reincarnate again, that it's not up to the Chinese authorities, and it's not up for political debate, but ultimately it's his decision whether he reincarnates as the Dalai Lama or not. And I mean this with I address this with all respect and affection for this spiritual tradition, this religious tradition. But what struck me in when I read that was that this is actually a solution to the problem of long-term value. That if it's true that we reincarnate, then there's really no problem in waiting on the long term. Then there's no problem in setting up our institutions in such a way that over the long term, they're going to deliver human society the greatest happiness. Because if we're reincarnating, then there's no tension between the living and future generations. That a focus on future generations under a reincarnating metaphysic does not require a self-sacrifice or a sacrifice of the interests of the present generation in the kind of final sense that it does if you believe that the living today are living their one and only life. I want to stress that my reading of that and my thinking that into the problem of the myth of long-term value was and is done with great sincerity. It's not a joke. It's not just a clever move to untangle a conceptual puzzle, but does instead, I think, lend metaphysical gravitas or an even deeper perspective on the nature of the problem of corporate design that I am pursuing. So with this in mind, came to campus early in anticipation of the Dalai Lama's visit. And the first of two sessions with the Dalai Lama is happening inside of our Levy Center, which is our basketball arena. And I was happily received a complimentary ticket, attend that function, but the face value of the ticket was $80. And they had packed this arena, filled to capacity, people standing, literally standing room only, in anticipation of the Dalai Lama's presence, arrival. And I thought to myself, who else could sell out this arena at $80 a head? U2 or, maybe a professional sports team could sell it out. But in terms of a political leader, a social leader, a cultural figure, a spiritual leader, but surely I don't think that if President Obama were coming to town, to Silicon Valley, I don't think they would sell out that arena, even if it was pitched as a fundraiser at $80 a head. And yet they were standing at the gates to try to catch a glimpse of this man. Later came to understand that $80 for the tickets was apparently just to cover the expenses associated with the Dalai Lama's visit. He comes with an entourage. There's a lot of security involved. There was reference to the CIA. There was reference to the Secret Service. So certainly a costly undertaking. But in anticipation of his arrival, there was great happiness inside that gymnasium. Finally, the Dalai Lama comes on stage. Then he was treated to a children's choir. I don't know how they were organized, but came on the stage, serenade him, after they were done, he walked right up to them, put his hand on the heads of the children, and bent down to shake the children's hand, and he was smiling and he was laughing, and the crowd laughed with him as he laughed, and there was great warmth and happiness. Then the Dalai Lama came to the podium. What he was saying at the first was he was remarking about how healthy the children looked. He was remarking about how healthy both in body and spirit and mind these young children appeared to be. And he was saying that it was very obvious to him that these children were well cared for. It was obvious to him that these children were well loved by their families and were well loved by their communities. It was clear to him that these children were eating well. It was clear to him that these were children who were being hugged a lot, that they were being loved a lot. These were children who were surrounded by affection. And he pitched this as a remark about the children, but as a kind of welcoming remark to us here in Silicon Valley, that he was saying he was commenting about our general healthfulness that he witnessed, that he saw, and he was complimenting us on it. But then he pivoted to talk about to suggest that this kind of healthfulness and happiness is often seen in children. But that when as children grow, as we become into adults, that we lose that happiness, we lose that state of well-being. And he said that the reason that we lose it is because we lose our compassion. And he started making the case, started saying that if you want to be happy yourself, that you need to treat other people well, that you need to, that if you have compassion for other people, that you're going to be happy yourself. That if you're suffering from anxiety, if you're suffering from depression, if you're frustrated in your own life, the way out is to care for other people around you. And he was insisting that this is not just good for the people around you, but it's good for you. It's mutually beneficial. That was the essence of his message. If you're familiar with Buddhism, frankly, for that matter, if you're familiar with Christianity, or if you're familiar with many of the world's religious traditions, most of which I'm not that familiar with, but to the extent that I am familiar with Buddhism, Christianity, you've heard that message before. In fact, if you're familiar with contemporary psychology, you've heard that message before, that service towards others, that an orientation towards engaging with other people and helping other people through their struggles is the hallowed path in our religious traditions, and frankly in contemporary psychology, is the latest teaching in terms of how we can best approach our own personal well-being, our own personal happiness. This is a very simple message. It's a profound message, but I realized this is what the Dalai Lama has to say. He's not claiming that he has anything more to say than this. This is what he is traveling the world and has been traveling the world his entire life, gathering in front of crowds of thousands of people to tell them, to remind them that if you are unhappy, the route to happiness lies in compassion for those around you. And what I realized about the crowd, all of whom had gathered there, is that that's why we had come. That's why there was so much excitement around our campus, is that we pretty much knew what the Dalai Lama had to say, and we were all gathering together as an occasion to celebrate the wisdom of that central insight. We were gathering together to remind ourselves of it, to be reminded of it, to just take an hour, 2 hours, the full day, whatever it took to become engaged in the Dalai Lama's visit, to take that time to be reapprised of that core truth about the nature of the human predicament that he was speaking to us. It was the essence of his very simple message that was the point of us all being there. What I did notice, reflecting on that message, is, again, its consonance with canonical corporate theory that is committed to the view that the way that corporations can make themselves happy, that is, the way that corporations can make themselves profitable, is by serving other people, is by serving consumers well, serving workers well, serving the environment well, serving communities well. The canonical account of corporate governance law tells us that if you want to be profitable, the best way to profitability is to serve these other stakeholders well. Now, I am skeptical of that account from within corporate theory for the reasons that I've elucidated previously in this podcast and in previous podcasts. I don't think it coheres as a matter of corporate theory. And yet, when the Dalai Lama expresses it as a matter of spiritual law, I find it persuasive, deeply moving, and am committed to it, even as I, you know, fail to live up to it. Is it possible that it is true as a spiritual matter, that it is true as a personal matter, that it is true as a communal matter, as a psychological matter, that the path to individual human flourishing lies in service to others, but that it's not true as an organizational matter, that law, that institutional design, that corporate theory can't be subsumed within that spiritual account? I don't know. Maybe my affection for the tale as the Dalai Lama tells it should make me less skeptical of the coherence of the long-term shareholder primacy account in corporate theory. But it doesn't. So that was basically the morning session, the large group gathering with the Dalai Lama. The afternoon session was pitched as a smaller gathering, though there were still, I think, several hundred people there, but more a gathering of business people and scholars in a panel discussion type program with the Dalai Lama. Now, here again, the crowd, I don't think everybody there had been at the morning session, so here again, there was great anticipation, excitement with the crowd. Now, for this session, Kirk Hansen, the executive director of the Markle Center, started off the panel discussion by trying to frame a couple of pressing, serious problems of business ethics and asking the Dalai Lama to engage them. I've got to give credit to Kirk because he didn't pitch a softball. Here he formulated what I think is, you know, one way of putting the essence of the problem. And the way Kirk put it was that here in Silicon Valley, we have our business environment is characterized by risk taking. It is riskiness. Undertaking risk is sort of a hallmark of our culture. It's worn as a badge of honor. It is understood to be the engine of our effectiveness in this valley. It is high stakes. It is understood to be a catalyst for our great companies, this atmosphere of risk-taking. And Kirk asked the Dalai Lama, how can this risk environment, how can compassion operate effectively in this environment of risk-taking, in this environment of hyper-competitiveness in which everyone is looking to create that next great product, that next great company? How can that risk environment be reconciled with the imperative towards compassion that the Dalai Lama emphasizes? I was on the edge of my seat. There was a quiet in the crowd. The question had been posed. The Dalai Lama, sitting there on his comfy chair that had been laid out for him, looked down, took about as much time as I'm taking right now, silently, reflecting, finally looked up, and he said, "I have nothing to say." There was a nervous laughter in the crowd. "Maybe others can speak, and I will maybe come up with some ideas," he said. I thought it was the most profound insight of the day. Hansen, Kirk Hansen, had posed the essence of the problem, and the Dalai Lama had the strength of character, the strength of intellect, the courage to say he didn't have an answer to that problem. That's something you're never going to hear an academic say at a conference struggling with the conundrums of corporate social responsibility. That you're never going to hear a politician respond that they don't have the answers. The Dalai Lama was set with the central problematic of reconciling the imperatives of corporate social responsibility or compassion and riskiness or competition in our environment here in Silicon Valley, and he spoke the truth. There's no good resolution to that problem. I don't have the answer to that problem. That was the wisdom that I'll take with me from the Dalai Lama's visit. You know, but the program didn't end there, because after the Dalai Lama invited others to speak, the organizers had called together some of our lions, some of our titans of business here in Silicon Valley to sit on the panel with him and to contribute to the conversation. And the first to speak right after the Dalai Lama announced that he had nothing to say on the question was Charles Geske, and I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, Chuck Geske, the co-founder of Adobe, right, one of our great Silicon Valley companies here, quintessential Silicon Valley company. Chuck started it in his garage, and today it's a $4 billion company, and he continues to co-chair the board of directors of Adobe. And Chuck, unlike the Dalai Lama, knew exactly what the answer was to Kirk's question. He, in his prepared remarks, very eloquently described how it was that Adobe was such a successful company. And what he told us was that Adobe treated its customers well, it treated its employees well, it has been concerned to be a good corporate citizen, that Adobe, from the beginning, has been committed to operating in a socially responsible way. But there was, for Chuck, no conflict between this compassionate approach to business and the risk-taking competitive environment that Kirk Hansen had described our economic circumstances as describing, because Chuck said it's not just the right thing to do, it's good business. In the long run, he knew that Adobe would be successful if it operated in this socially responsible way, and he was proved right. And so there you go. No tension at all. The Dalai Lama listened to this story, and he shook his head as if this was a coherent response, and said, "Very good, very good." And he smiled. I've no doubt that Adobe was successful by being a good corporate citizen, by serving its stakeholders well, by serving its consumers and its customers and employees well. I have no doubt that that is true. But I also have no doubt that other companies in our economy, other companies in other sectors of the economy, thrive and are able to be profitable by engaging in exploitative practices. And the anecdotal example of Adobe's success is not responsive to the reality of that situation, otherwise operating in our legal and economic landscape. In fact, it's no more responsive to talk about an anecdote of one company doing well by serving its stakeholders well than it is persuasive to look at other companies, tobacco companies, oil companies, pharmaceutical companies that have been wildly successful by arguably exploiting its stakeholders. I say again, we could pile up vignettes of successful companies that have succeeded by being socially responsible, and we could pile up just as many vignettes of companies that have been successful through an exploitative approach. Such counting, that kind of empiricism, is not going to decide the question of what kind of corporate law we should have in our society. The indeterminacy of the empirical inquiry must compel us to examine the question from a theoretical perspective. I'm not saying that the theoretical perspective is decisive either, but in the face of the indeterminacy of the empirical counting approach, the theoretical perspective has to have an important place in the conversation. And I'm making the case that from the theoretical perspective, the canonical shareholder primacy account that companies should be invited to run their operations in such a way that is oriented only at maximizing shareholder profits and that is going to lift all boats along the way does not add up, despite the anecdote of Adobe being successful in that path. This is no criticism of Chuck Geske. His comments were eloquent, they were thoughtful, they were beautifully rendered and appropriate to the occasion. Chuck is a businessman, a wildly successful businessman. He's done great things for this for this valley. He's done great things for the economy as a whole. If you've ever used Adobe and any Adobe product, and I do probably on a weekly, if not a daily basis, he's contributed to your social utility, to your individual utility. Okay, so he's a hero, but his theory of corporate social responsibility is not responsive to the problem that Hansen posed and is not an answer where the Dalai Lama had none. And similarly, another panelist, Jane Shaw, the now retired chairperson of the Intel Corporation, another great Silicon Valley firm, told a fascinating story on the panel about Intel being apprised or coming to be apprised of the fact by social activists that it was using, that the entire hardware industry, computer hardware industry, microprocessor industry, I don't understand these technical terms, was using precious metals that precious minerals that are very important to the design, to the manufacture of these circuits. We're using precious minerals that were being procured in exploitative ways through mining operations in war-torn, chaotic, exploitative settings involving the use of child labor, slave labor, etc. Conflict mineral, to use a term associated with this problem. And Ms. Shaw went into a elaborate story about Intel's work to study up on the problem and to design a system that other companies have since been able to replicate and use, in which it was ultimately able to track the sourcing of the minerals that it was using in its operations, until finally today Intel is able to certify proudly that all the minerals used in the production of its microprocessors or chips or whatever Intel makes are conflict free. Now, along the way, Ms. Shaw described this as a socially responsible undertaking, as Intel's desire to do something that was to do the right thing. And in fact, she said that it cost us money to do it. It cost us time to do it, but they were doing it because it was the right thing. But then, of course, at the end of the story, it turns out that it was also the profitable thing to do because it was good for employees. It was good for consumers who were concerned about these conflict minerals, and so ultimately it was good for shareholders. And so Ms. Shaw too was absolutely certain, or the moral of her story was that once again there's no conflict between the risk-taking environment, the competitive environment, and the imperatives of compassion that Kirk Hansen had posed as a tension, and that the Dalai Lama had said, "I have no answer to that conundrum." For Ms. Shaw of Intel, just as surely as it was for the co-founder of Adobe, there is no conflict. Corporation serves its shareholders and all other stakeholders at the same time by behaving in a socially responsible way. If it were really true that the route to the greatest profitability for corporations is to serve the interests of its stakeholders attentively, conscientiously, deliberately, compassionately, then we would expect to see corporate governance norms that reflected that reality, would we not? If it were true that what's best for shareholders is to actively attend to the interests of multiple stakeholders, wouldn't we expect corporate law to require directors to do that instead of requiring directors to manage the firm in the interest of the shareholders? If it was true that not just anecdotally, not just with respect to the software industry or some particularly successful firms in the Silicon Valley, if it were true that the best route for corporations generally to profitability is to attend to the interests of multiple stakeholders, wouldn't we expect capital to be flowing to jurisdictions that offered corporate charters that commanded directors to manage their firms in that fashion? Instead, we see just the opposite. We see capital flowing to Delaware, which continues to dominate in the sale of corporate charters, which has a law that states very precisely that the obligations of directors are to manage the firm in the interest of shareholders. And when there are conflicts, the obligation of a Delaware director is to privilege the shareholders. Again, this is no critique. There's no criticism of Ms. Shaw. She, too, was eloquent. She was articulate. She was persuasive. It was a beautiful story that she told. And no doubt, Intel did a great humanitarian benefit, boon, by taking a leadership role in the resolution of the conflict minerals problem. Even in that story, were there not time horizon conflicts between the shareholders and the workers and the suppliers and the consumers with respect to what kind of a time horizon should dictate our pursuit of the resolution of this problem? I have no doubt that Intel pursued the problem in a sense with all dispatch, but I'm also certain that they did not pursue resolution of the problem in a way that was seeking to solve it irrespective of the impact on shareholders or irrespective of the impact on shareholders over some time horizon. I'm just trying to identify as a matter of theory the irreconcilable tension between these stakeholders over some time horizon to get us back to the place where the Dalai Lama started, which is not knowing how to resolve these real tensions. Well, I'll close now by reiterating the final one of the final messages that the Dalai Lama delivered. He got excited by the Intel story and the Adobe story, and I think it gave him some energy or some motive to say a little bit more than he had theretofore in the day about compassion, just to talk about it in a little bit more nuance that I found useful and that I will continue to take with me. He talked about a couple of different levels or layers of the compassionate approach to life, the compassionate approach to well-being. And what he said was that you begin by taking a holistic perspective, trying to think about other people and the world, and that this holistic perspective will trigger within you, if you're open to it, a caring, an affection for other people. A purely kind of visceral, he was saying, visceral, emotional, affective connection with other people. And that is the hook, as you know, he sort of described that. That's the first step in the compassionate approach. Then the second step, he said, is a little bit more cerebral, in which you develop a sense of responsibility towards those other people that you care about, that you have an obligation or a desire or a drive, not just to care about them, but to improve their lot. So the first step is develop a holistic approach, which will trigger an emotional response of caring. That's a condition precedent, as we would say in the law, to developing a sense of responsibility. And then, said the Dalai Lama, comes another layer that is much more intellectually oriented. And that is where the compassionate individual really has to think hard about what can be done to care for the individuals or the people or the communities that one has compassion for. And that he described as a very difficult undertaking is that intellectual approach to develop what he called realistic responses to the suffering of the people that you're concerned with. And he then said that the best way to improve your chances of achieving some useful result in that intellectual domain is to have a calm mind, because if you have a mind that is freed from the interferences of anger or of jealousy, temptations of a baser sort, a calm mind is one that is going to be more successful at developing the intelligent response to the imperative of responsibility that can serve the care, the affection that one develops for other people when they begin to think holistically about the nature of the human predicament. And so I took the Dalai Lama to be saying that if we are concerned with questions of corporate social responsibility, if we are concerned with developing a coherent, socially desirable corporate law, that it's imperative upon us to work towards a calm mind, that we might have a better chance of developing an intellectually useful response to the compassion imperative. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Corporate Social Responsibility Podcast. Subscribe to us on iTunes. You can follow us on Twitter at David Yosifon. That's David YOSIFON. I'll tweet it every time we put up a new episode. This episode was sponsored by the Markle Center for Applied Ethics, although the opinions and ideas expressed here are mine alone. I'm going to go meditate. Then I'm going to do some corporate theory. Then I'm going to have lunch. Enjoy your day. Talk to you next time.